We're on a river flowing through the countryside of Assam in northeast India. A fisherman casts his net from the bank into this tributary of the mighty Brahmaputra. The net lands within meters of one of the world's most endangered freshwater mammals.
Yeah, they're dolphins. Just where these two currents are actually merging, they're dolphins.
The Ganges River dolphin, foraging where two branches of the river meet.
The dolphin's trying to feed, so it's just foraging along, and it just literally just broke the water very quickly to come up for breath. It was only very quick.
There, another one, yeah, tail slapping. Yeah. So I think four or five will be here, in and around this area.
This used to be a common sight throughout the whole Brahmaputra and Ganges River systems. But its rarity these days is leading us to think that this species' ultimate fate might be the same as its Chinese cousin, the Yangtze River dolphin. In 2007, that cetacean was declared functionally extinct. The Ganges River dolphin is one of many thousands of species known to be seriously threatened with extinction, along with probably millions for which we simply don't have hard data, but we assume are under threat. So in this programme, we're looking at what we know about the current extinction crisis in the world today. Are we on the verge of a mass extinction, like those global megadeaths of the deep past, where most species were wiped out in a geological heartbeat? But first, how many have we pushed over the brink already, and how many are teetering before oblivion? The most authoritative data comes from the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the IUCN. But assessing species and their risk of disappearing is an accounting nightmare. So far, we've looked at 50,000, which is just 3% of all species of animals and plants described. Even for that sample, the numbers are frightening. Anthony Barnosky of the University of California in Berkeley.
The numbers that have actually gone extinct in the last 500 years range 1%, 2% possibly, depending on the group you're dealing with. If you look at how many of the species in that group are threatened with extinction, then the numbers go up to 40%, depending on the group.
Threatened species are put on the IUCN's so-called red list. Georgina Mace, a conservation biologist at Imperial College London, develops the criteria for what should be deemed at risk of extinction.
What we're trying to measure in the red list is how likely a species is to go extinct if current conditions prevail. And there are two or three fundamental ways that you could decide a species was going to go extinct, if you like, the symptoms of extinction. One would be it's in long-term progressive decline. However big the population size is, if it's losing 1 or 5 or 10% or 20% a year, it's heading towards extinction. The other is species that are restricted to very small areas. So they may not be declining, but they're very rare, or they're very fragmented. There might be quite a lot of them, but every single subpopulation consists of a small number of individuals.
Such as?
A number of bird species that are restricted to the tops of a few mountains or to a little patch of habitat. There are many bird species like this in the Pacific Islands. There are quite a lot of amphibians, mammals and birds actually in montane restricted habitats in, say, South America, in the Andes and so on. So these two things, large or small but declining and very small or fragmented, were the two basic kinds of criteria.
What's that? That's a golden tamarin, is it?
It's a golden lion tamarin, yeah.
In the rainforest enclosure at London Zoo, that beautiful tiny monkey is one of many creatures marked as critically endangered. It's charming and eye-catching. But our ignorance of lesser-spotted and undiscovered species makes calculating extinction numbers extremely hard, according to Ben Collin at the Zoological Society of London.
We're certainly finding species in some groups at very rapid rates. So plant species, for example, are getting described at a rate of many a day. So in one way, there's a problem there in trying to understand what that new diversity means. But as rapidly as we're finding new species, we're also losing species.
As rapidly, though. That can't be right. That can't be. The numbers don't add up like that, though. Because if we're 10 times lower on the number of species that exist, we're not losing them at that rate, are we? We just haven't found enough.
But you don't know how many there are out there, so what's the pot that you're drawing from?
That's true.
So it could be right. But, I mean, identifying and classifying a species as extinct, it's actually a very complex process. On the face of it, it appears very simple. You know, we look for something, we find it's not there, and we declare that it's extinct. But as species get rare, we obviously have less chance to see them. We don't have the scientific expeditions, perhaps, in the right places. So a species can go unseen for many, many years, and we don't really have an appreciation of whether it's still there or not. So actually diagnosing a species as extinct is something that scientists are quite reticent to do, and that means that our extinct species list lag behind our new discoveries.
Yeah, there's one.
Back in the state of Assam in India, conservation biologist Abdul Waqid recognises an old friend.
Okay, so we named one dolphin as Rosie. I think that Rosie is arriving here. Eh, Chandan? Yeah, it's a black colour, so it's really big. Yeah.
Ganges River dolphins grow to about 2.5 metres in length from their tail flukes to their toothy snouts. Working for the Indian conservation organisation Aranyak, Waqid has been accounting for them since 2005. He's recently joined forces on this project with Lucy Bodham-Wetham from the Zoological Society of London.
Pretty incredible. I mean, we've seen quite a few dolphins breach the water, but it's just a very brief second where you see them. So as soon as you catch them, they're gone. So it's quite a special thing. But there's dolphins a bit further away from the boat that are actually diving out of the water and splashing, whereas normally you just sort of see a bit of a hump and dorsal fin.
The total population is thought to number about 2,500, with the majority of them in the Ganges system, which flows through India's most developed and polluted regions. Waqid's 2008 estimate for the population in the Brahmaputra River is just 300.
Actually, we have surveyed something around 1,050 kilometres stretch of the river. 300 dolphins, it's too low. And it's a big river system. It's a mighty Brahmaputra. Its average width is something around 14 to 18 kilometres wide. In that big river system, 300 is nothing.
That's far fewer than just a couple of decades ago.
We had many dolphins in the past, two or three decades ago. So when we talk with that elder person back to the riverside villages, they said many, many dolphins in the past.
That long-term downward trend in numbers is a classic symptom of extinction risk.
With the extinction of the Yangtze River dolphin only a few years ago, it's very possible. Although they're a different species and actually a different family, they're living in a similar environment, they have a similar biology. And we've seen what happened in China with the overdevelopment, the unsustainable development, and there wasn't clear management in place. And not only did that deplete the dolphin, but it also wiped out lots of fish species. And it's one of the most polluted rivers in the world, which is not good for anybody. So I think, especially here with the Brahmaputra, we have an opportunity to try and learn from those lessons and stop things before they get too bad and too similar to that situation.
There are myriad threats to the Ganges River dolphin here and elsewhere in South Asia, all bearing mankind's dirty fingerprints. Nets that scourge the rivers of even the tiniest fish deprive the dolphins of food. They drown in another kind of widely used fishing net. Dam projects stem river flows and isolate populations. And in places, they're hunted for their oil. All classic dangers affecting species across the globe. Georgina Mace and Anthony Barnoski.
We've got growing human populations, which is causing habitat fragmentation. So we're actually taking away the places other species need to live. We are vastly changing the surface of the planet through agriculture and other activities. We now have something like 40% of the Earth's land surface devoted to farms and ranches and so on. So those are places that other species can't live.
Another one is direct exploitation. People hunt various species. We fish a lot of wild fish. A third one is introduced species. Sometimes we're moving species around the world and they interbreed with native species. We've had a lot of that in this country, red squirrels and grey squirrels, for example. A fourth one is just pollution of the environment. addition of chemicals to both land and fresh water has been increasingly important over recent decades.
And then finally, on top of all that, is global climate change. By the year 2070, by any of the reasonable climate projections, Earth is going to be a hotter place than it's been since Homo sapiens evolved. If we go on the more worst-case scenario projections, by the year 2100, Earth is going to be a hotter place than it's been in the past 3 million years, which is longer than most mammal species that are living today have been on Earth. So we're going into a time that is very different than the species living today have ever experienced. So that in itself is a wild card with climate change. The other thing that is really, really important to realize is now the places where we want to save biodiversity are largely these isolated islands surrounded by seas of agriculture or cities or whatever. So as climate changes in those preserves, those species really don't have any way to get from where they are now to where they would need to be to keep experiencing the climate that is suitable for them. So we've put barriers up to their migration.
So it's not looking good at all. The Earth has seen five catastrophic extinctions in its deep past, where the majority of life was sent into the void. And we know a fair bit about how they came to pass. So the big question is this. Are we in the sixth great extinction?
I think we're on the edge of it, yes. I think that we're on part of a rising curve of extinction rates. Exactly how high that rising curve will get depends on what we do in the next few decades, whether it goes into a really massive wave of extinction or whether we can limit it in some way. But all the evidence is that if you do the numbers, and the numbers are quite difficult to do to compare extinction rates today with those previous ones, we're very close. If we take the groups that are reasonably well assessed, so although we've only looked at a tiny proportion of the world's species, we have looked at all the birds, mammals and amphibians. So of that group that have been systematically examined, every species has been looked at, the extinction rate that you get from them is about one species per year that's going extinct. And if you try to relate that back to what we call background rates in the fossil record, and it is difficult because the timescales vary and the sampling methods vary, it's on the edge of the estimates of what rates were like in these major extinctions in the fossil record.
Anthony Barnosky led a group of researchers who carried out a landmark study comparing extinction rates today with those of past mass extinctions. Amongst all this doom-mongering, there is a glimmer of hope.
We're very much in danger of going into a sixth mass extinction. The good news is that we haven't come very far in terms of numbers of species lost yet. So we still have most of what we want to save in the world out there to save, but we're kind of at a crossroads where we have to make a choice to do that. Where we have the best fossil record and also the most confident knowledge in the modern world happens to be with mammals. We can match up those two fairly well. And if we use that data, and we can also bring in some information from other vertebrate groups, amphibians, reptiles, and birds. What's happening today and over historic times, say the past 100 to 500 years, extinction rates are at least 3 to 12 times too high compared to normal background rates. They could be as high as 80 times too high. Now, previous estimates have been even higher than that. We tried to take a very conservative view and say, you know, if you compare the data in such a way to make the differences between modern and fossil background rates the least they could reasonably be, this is what we come up with, 3 to 12 times too high.
Which means that if we don't fix this mess, 3/4 of mammal species will be wiped out in as little as 3 centuries. Now, scientists can be a quarrelsome lot, and there's a lot of disagreement about these numbers. But in practical terms, as Paul Ehrlich of Stanford University's Centre for Conservation Biology says, getting agreement on the number crunching isn't going to make a jot of difference to the overall picture.
We don't have good ways of accurately estimating the loss of species. People think we biologists know more about the world than they actually do. But what we do know is that when you travel around, if you're an experienced field biologist, you keep finding place after place where the habitat has been utterly destroyed. You find example after example of things that used to be common that are no longer common. I've been all over the world, I've looked everywhere, and what you see is a continuing picture of destruction. Since people can't determine whether there's 10 million species or even maybe 100 million species, because we haven't explored the planet that well and it's disappearing while we're trying to explore it, how could you possibly say that the rate is this or the rate is that? Anybody who says that not to worry about it, that some people say that we're losing 0.5% of species a year, other people say we're losing 3%, others say we're losing 0.1%, it doesn't matter. We're losing it.
Accurate figures about animal numbers aren't without value. The River Dolphin Project in Assam counts the individual dolphins along the Brahmaputra, so the conservationists can take hard figures to the authorities for action. Aboard Aranyak's main survey vessel, Chandan Ree describes the accounting process during their month-long census as they chug down the river from one end of the state to the other.
In our survey, we have two teams, and one is the primary team and a secondary. We have two decks on the boat, and the primary team sits in the front deck, and the secondary is just on top of it. And what we do is we follow the middle of the river, and when we see dolphins, we gauge the distance and the angle at which the dolphin has been sighted. We look for how many individuals, which is the group size, and also the age class, whether it's a calf, adult, or a juvenile. And whenever we do our dolphin survey, we also look for various human disturbances in and around the dolphin habitat, which can be related why dolphins are found and why dolphins are not found at that particular place.
It's really important that we try and establish a good understanding of what the numbers are so that we can go to the authorities and the government and say, look, this is what's happening, we need to do something about it now. And it's particularly, you know, the Brahmaputra river system is huge, and we might find that there's, you know, population numbers might be stable or increasing in one area but decreasing in another, and we need to localize that and actually say, okay, why is that a decrease or why is that an increase, what is happening out there with the human population, so that we can be better informed about what we can do in the future. And that's the ultimate goal of this project, is to develop a strategy and a conservation action plan that can be then implemented by the government to try and protect not only the river dolphin but also to sustainably manage the fisheries and the natural resources here in the Brahmaputra.
These dolphins are not only at the top of the food chain, they're one of the more visible and attractive species in trouble. Along with pandas and tigers and rhinos, they're called charismatic animals, and projects to protect them draw public support. But back at London Zoo, Ben Collin and Monica Boehm are engaged in surveying and preserving the much more numerous species that form the bulk of ecosystems.
We're trying to focus on sort of the less well-studied, the less well-understood species that play a very large role in our ecosystems, in the habitats that humans derive many benefits from. So we're standing underneath these branches here, so we get wood, we get fibres, we get food, we get water filtration from the ecosystems that we live in, and the flora and fauna that are responsible for providing those benefits to us are quite often the smaller things, the things that the public don't care about so much, and the things that we know least about.
It sounds like we're getting some comment from this trumpeter
bird. A little bit of commentary.
And an armadillo.
And we've got an armadillo as well, rustling around at our feet.
So when you talk about the other species, the flora and the fauna, which aren't Mr. Armadillo, who's right at our feet here, and Trumpy the trumpeter bird, what sort of species are you talking about?
Things like freshwater mollusks, dung beetles, dragonflies, butterflies, grasshoppers, things that there are many thousands of species of, different species of, some of which we know a great deal about, some of which we know very little. Those things tend to be very abundant, and so in that way they can provide a lot more substance to the ecosystem than something that's very rare. And those rare things with big eyes and furry bodies and that the public really buy into perhaps have less of a role in those systems.
Monica, how do you explain this to people at parties, that what you're interested in is conserving the dung beetle?
It actually makes for very good dinner conversation, to be quite honest. It's my friends, honestly. They keep asking me, how are the freshwater mollusks? How are the dung beetles?
The consequences of losing one of these species, what would happen if freshwater mollusks on their own disappeared from the ecosystem? What would happen to the pyramid?
In terms of freshwater mollusks, it's actually quite a good example. We're currently carrying out an assessment of freshwater mollusks, and they do actually play a very important role in our freshwater ecosystems. Particularly mussels, they are very important for water filtration, and they're also incredibly good indicators of what's actually going on with our freshwater systems, because they're very sensitive to pollution and all these things. So at the moment we're actually seeing really high rates of extinction risk in freshwater mollusks, which is pretty worrying given the fact that we all depend on freshwater just as much as they do.
There are millions of species of beetles. If one type of dung beetle goes extinct, then are there not many more that could fill that niche?
It is likely that there might be some other species around that fulfills the same function, yes. But I think we do not know how many species provide the same functioning. It's this concept of resilience within an ecosystem as well that you want to conserve. So really, how many species can we take out before it breaks down? And that's something that we really do not have an idea about. So ideally, we want to lose as little as possible.
One of the key issues with invertebrates is we don't truly understand their role within the system. So as we continually chip away at that, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly, because we don't understand these species, we risk hitting points where the functions that we derive from systems really drop away very quickly and in a way that we can't get them back. So we're, in effect, pulling out sticks without knowing what they're supporting.
So what are you working with here? You're dealing with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of potential sticks that we could yank out.
Yep, and we have very little appreciation of which of those is the most important stick. Aldo Leopold said, to keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering. So, if you're going to take something apart, you better keep every single part of it in order to put it back together. That's what we're working with here, where we can never hope to assess and understand, the full complement of a million plus beetles, but we can take a manageable subset of those, research those, find out what sort of extinction risks they face, and from that understand what's happening to the group as a whole, so that we have an appreciation of what that group means in terms of ecosystem function.
Species don't exist in one large village. They're spread out across countries and continents as sometimes entirely distinct populations. Paul Ehrlich thinks that's where we need to focus.
Well, population extinctions virtually always precede species extinctions. Most species occur as a wide variety of populations in different places, often evolutionarily different populations. And what we're doing right now is wiping out huge numbers of populations. And we don't get the same level of species extinction until we get the end of the line on each one. So if there's 1,000 populations in a species, it takes time to wipe out all 1,000 of them before you've lost the species. The way to see that population extinctions are crucial is to realize that if you could wave a magic wand and say every species on the planet would be preserved as one viable population for the rest of eternity, the species extinction crisis would be over. Right? And we'd all be dead in a few months because we absolutely depend on a wide variety of populations that run the ecological systems, the ecosystems that are supporting our lives. For example, in the U.S., something like $20 billion a year in our agricultural production depends on pollinators. So when you have a collapse with your bees, that's going to affect your pollination and it's going to hit your economy. Now, if we had one population of honeybees in Italy, that wouldn't do a damn thing for pollinating crops in North America. If you only had one population, say, of birds of paradise, that wouldn't do much for New Guinea's tourist industry because you have to have lots of populations so you can get people out to see them. All the things that we basically want to get from nature, with very trivial exceptions, depend on having various populations, often large numbers of populations.
So from a practical point of view, Paul Ehrlich suggests that historically, many conservationists have focused too much on protecting individual charismatic species and missed the bigger picture.
Much more important to us are pollinators and organisms that make our soils fertile and the plants that absorb the carbon dioxide that we're putting too much of into the atmosphere and screwing up our climate and so on. I think the main thing that should be done differently is to inform the public much more about the ecosystem services so that they're quite happy, for example, to put political support and financial support into protecting entire ecosystems. So we should be putting the effort into protecting the charismatic species and gigantically higher effort into protecting the systems and the populations. Because, you know, you get some jerk sitting in a Wall Street office who knows nothing about the world, and he says, why in hell should I protect the pandas? I'm never going to see a panda. I don't care about pandas. The only thing I care about is boozing and stealing people's money. Typical Wall Streeter. But if you say, if we don't protect the ecosystems, you're not going to have any food. You're going to starve. Then you can get the message off. And we have a built-in audience with self-interest in saving the ecosystems and the populations. We only have a relatively minor portion of humanity that really cares about polar bears, that really cares about pandas, that really cares about beautiful birds, and so on.
The point is that humans are part of the world, not merely on it. And that makes a very good reason for us to put the brakes on. But we're also moral creatures, and that should be part of the philosophy of our conservation efforts, says Anthony Barnosky.
I talk to students a lot about why should we preserve biodiversity, and this business of do we have a moral responsibility comes up quite a bit. And, you know, oftentimes people will start off saying, well, if it comes down to between animals and humans, you know, these other animals got to die, right? But then you throw out a hypothetical situation. I like to say, all right, let me give you a razor blade, and you walk into the Louvre and start slashing up every Rembrandt you can find. Try to get rid of all of them. And everybody in the room gasps, and they say, we couldn't do that. Those are irreplaceable. Okay? So I think that's the kind of thinking that you really have to translate to our responsibility for keeping other species alive.
For Paul Ehrlich, morality is only one aspect of why we should be trying our very best to stop the looming sixth great extinction dead in its tracks.
Humanity is carrying on a vast campaign of sawing on the limb it's sitting on. And the limb we're sitting on, of course, is all those populations of other organisms that support our lives. So what's more or less certain is it's deeply stupid. So if you don't have a moral feeling about it, then think, don't you want to belong to a species that acts intelligently rather than stupidly?